Those June 23. This is the second of three oral arguments. Judges Ross and Kirk join me, Judge Sleater. I'm presiding today. And as counsel will both see, or I assume you both see the clock in the corner of our Zoom setting here today. What I'll ask counsel when you begin your comments is to identify your name for the record and who you represent. And if for some reason we lose connection, the marshal knows to cease the clock, the time, and we will wait until you get back connected. The second case is A220104, Matthias Jacob Gould, appellant versus State of Minnesota as respondent. And so counsel for appellant, you may identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, opposing counsel, Taylor Rahm, R-A-H-M, here on behalf of appellant Matthias Gould. We are here this morning on relief we are seeking from the court on a post-conviction petition that was denied. An evidentiary hearing was denied at the district court level. We are asking the court, to reverse that decision and allow us to have an evidentiary hearing, as we believe we are entitled to that. There are two claims made in our memorandum in regards to, first being that Mr. Gould did not enter an intelligent plea. I think it's clear from the record, all the affidavits submitted and the district court order that there is no had the cognitive ability of a 14-year-old. The district court didn't dispute that in its final order, denying any relief. Well, and this was,
is there any evidence that a 14-year-old would lack the understanding? I mean, I understand that. I mean, I don't want to disparage a whole class of people, but I have strong suspicion that if you had a cognitive or a judgment-based emotional IQ test of some sort in prison, that you'd probably find 14 years of age to be somewhere around the median of individual capacity. I mean, people who are in prison are often individuals who have make very bad judgment calls, and often it's based upon rather immature mental decision-making. Do you disagree with that?
Your Honor, I don't know that I disagree with the overall conclusion that people in prison, I don't have the data of what the relevant or what the stats would be on that. But what I would state is we know, obviously, not to confuse the two, you know, this is not a juvenile case, as obviously Mr. Gould was 18 years old or over at that time.
Right.
But there's a reason when we're aware that a juvenile who is 14 years old comes before a court, that a parent or a guardian or someone is there to make sure they understand what is occurring. Here,
what I'm suggesting to you, I guess, and not suggesting, I'm just inquiring, since 14 years seems to be the age that has been assigned to your client as far as his intellectual or cognitive functioning, I'm wondering whether you believe that differs substantially from criminal defendants generally. And I'm talking about adults.
I do, Your Honor, in regards to the way this case was handled by the attorney and by the court. I would note, you know, as pointed out in my memorandum, that this was presented in a confusing way. You can look straight to the transcript from the plea hearing, which is document number 26, page 6 of that. The attorney says that, okay, on the plea petition, as you and I talked about, you've read, you understand by taking a deal today. There was no deal made in this case. And the district court actually, in a few pages later, corrects the attorneys that this is a straight plea. There's no deal. There was nothing negotiated in regards to dismissing a case or what was going to happen. It was a straight plea, not a deal. And that's exactly what Mr. Gould believed it was. There was some sort of deal. And that's based upon what his attorney told him. And you can see his attorney used the word deal on page 6 of the plea transcript. This was not a deal.
Let me go. We have had a number of cases in our court and the Supreme Court where we have affirmed the summary dismissal of a petition for post-conviction relief, based upon apparent direct conflicts between what is alleged in the affidavits or petition and what was admitted to at the plea colloquy. So here's a, there's an exchange here where between Mr. Downs and the defendant, Mr. Downs. Now it says you have a 10th grade education. You can read and write, correct? Defendant says, yes. And it goes on and the attorney says, and I can attest to that because I've worked with you. You understand, as you and I have discussed, and the form says, and then it goes on to go over a number of things that presumably is understood because the defendant A has a 10th grade education and can read and write. Do you think a 10th grade education, someone who has the capability of having a 10th grade education would presumably or necessarily have sufficient cognitive skills to understand what was happening in the plea and in substance and in detail?
Perhaps, Your Honor, but I would also argue to the court that even a 30-year-old or a medical doctor would have been confused at what was going on in this case, as there's no mention about a presumption of 144 months prison during the plea transcript. There's no mention of substantial and compelling factors. There's no mention of the burden of proof to get a departure. And in regards to that, it's page 9 of the plea transcript, the word potential prison time is used by the attorney. This isn't potential prison time. This is presumed prison time. That's a huge distinction, that under the law, Mr. Gold was presumed that he should spend 144 months in jail if and until he can prove to the court by clear convincing standard that there are substantial and compelling factors to depart. So no matter what would have been recommended by probation, the district court under the Minnesota sentencing guidelines could have sentenced Mr. Gold to 144 months, and that's what was presumed. That was not articulated at all at the plea hearing, that, you know, why there was no mention of, you understand that right now you're presumed to go to prison for 144 months. Well, that's the presumption.
There was a plea petition in this case, correct?
There was, Your Honor. And the way in which that plea petition was gone through was Mr. Downs sent that through jail staff to Mr. Gould, a 14-year-old in regards to cognitive ability, and he was left to read through that and go through that on his own. Now, I understand this was during COVID. Procedures were a little different, but that doesn't excuse an attorney to allow, again, even if you're a medical doctor or someone who's extremely intelligent, you don't understand the law. There are plenty of attorneys that don't understand the law. And the fact that this was given to essentially a 14-year-old, and he was set to go through it by himself in a jail cell, it shocks the conscience that an attorney would do that. And it even is mentioned by Mr. Downs, where he states, okay, I sent up to you yesterday or 2 days ago a form that you read and signed. He acknowledges that this form was sent to Mr. Gold. There's no dispute in regards to that. So while there was a plea petition filled out in this case, again, there are plenty of lawyers that don't understand everything in a plea petition. And in this case, Mr. Gold was left to go through it on his own.
Counsel, the plea here didn't involve just that petition. That wasn't filed and the sentence was ordered. There was a plea hearing. The defense counsel went over, in general terms, the plea petition, and your client indicated he understood all that. The fact that he signed the petition earlier was covered. That's the way pleas are done. On the ground. I was a trial court judge for 23 years. And I can tell you, I've heard many times things such as, you know, we're looking and hoping for a departure so we can avoid the potential of jail time. And I think everybody in the courtroom knew what the presumptive sentence was. They didn't have to say it, including your client.
Well, Your Honor, I, again, was respectfully disagree in regards. There were, in addition to my client's affidavit, there were also family members who submitted affidavits, including his grandfather, who, again, acknowledged holds his hand. That was acknowledged by Mr. Down, the attorney at the time. And there was confusion on their end on what was occurring. So while there was a a plea hearing. There's no doubt about that. There's nothing in regards, again, to what the potential consequences could be, no matter how well things went for Mr. Gold. This is a presumptive prison sentence. And when you read through the plea transcript, it does not come out that the presumptive is 144 months or that that's what's likely going to occur. And my client did not understand that. And again, you're dealing the part of the respondent's memorandum, their argument is, well, he didn't speak up, you know, during the plea hearing. Again, as noted throughout my memorandum, you're dealing again with a 14-year-old who's putting the trust in his attorney that things are going to work out the way he understands them to work out. That is that he's not going to be going to prison, let alone for 144 months.
Mr. Rahm, how do we get around, in addition to the petition and other comments made, when your client's attorney says that the question is that not part of the plea agreement, but part of the plan, we're going to attempt to get you to treatment. And is that correct? Yes. And our hope is that you can avoid potential prison time by doing well in treatment on a pretrial status. Correct? And he said, yes. Now, I understand your point earlier about potential, but in the context of what he was saying, the potential, as I read that, and as it appears to me, maybe it was a poor choice of words, but had more to do with avoiding prison, the potential, but you have to do well in treatment. And isn't that the crux of the post-conviction petition, is that the bottom line is if he did well in treatment, his chances for departure were greater than not, and he didn't do well, so there was no departure.
And I think, again, that was the confusion on client's part in regards to how dire the success in treatment was to a departure. And again, his understanding going into that is that he was not going to be going to prison. And, you know, the attorney, again, at one point during that called it a deal, as I pointed out earlier, and it was, look, even to the sentencing transcript, which is document number 42, the lawyer clearly states that Mr. Gold doesn't understand that he can be going to prison. I mean, that is proof in and of itself. It's coming right from the attorney's mouth that Mr. Gold didn't understand that he could be going to prison. That is proof in and of itself that he was confused about what was happening, because if he understood that if he did not do well in treatment, he was going to prison, then he should have known, I didn't do well in treatment, I'm going to prison.
And didn't the attorney also say at the sentencing hearing that, and I saw this in your brief, and I understand the point, that he doesn't believe he's going to prison, despite the fact that I've told him repeatedly, including today. So in other words, we have in the record, the attorney repeatedly told his client, you're going to prison. How do we, how does that affect your client's position here with regard to what he understood or didn't understand? And our case law that as inquired earlier, that seems an opposite of what everything during the hearing itself said. In other words, he knew he was going to prison.
Well, in your honor, I think that's the point of an evidentiary hearing, because in the affidavit submitted on our side, that's not what the attorney was telling him. And under the law, in determining whether an evidentiary hearing is required, a post-conviction court considers the facts alleged in the petition as true and construes them in light most favorable to the petitioner. Petitioner here contradicts, does not agree that the attorney was telling him he could be going to prison. And as I put it in the brief, if that was actually occurring before the plea hearing, make a record of it and as an attorney and say, I've explained to my client that he could go to prison, that it's presumed that he could go to prison, but he just doesn't understand that. That wasn't placed on the record. And the sentencing transcript shows that Mr. Gold was telling, or according to Mr. Downs, Mr. Gold did not understand that he could be going to prison. And when you look again at all of this, it was brought to Mr. Downs acknowledges at the sentencing transcript that Mr. Dennis Gold brought Matthias Gold to him to have him represent him, that he holds his hand. And as pointed out in the affidavits, it was brought to Mr. Downs' attention that Mr. Dennis Gold was to be involved in everything to help make sure that Matthias Gold understood what was going on. And a normal, reasonable attorney, knowing that, that you're dealing with a client that has a cognitive ability of a 14-year-old and is requesting that his grandfather be allowed to know what's going on. The grandfather is asking to be a part of it. And then they go forward with the plea hearing without grandpa having the opportunity to speak with client. And the district court in its final order is inaccurate when it states that the family was present for the plea hearing. They were not, they were present for the sentencing hearing, but they were not present for the plea hearing. And the district court is also incorrect when they say that the family understood what the plea agreement was, because that's contradicted in the affidavits and even the email sent by Mr. Dennis Gold to Mr. Downs saying, hey, I was a little confused at what you told me. Here's my understanding of it. Is this accurate? So there's clearly confusion going on in why an attorney would not allow the grandfather at the request of client to be involved in every part of this as a given that client is 14 years old and given that the attorney sent the plea petition via the jail and didn't go through with his client. Clearly, this shocks the conscience and is not representation that you would expect from a competent, normal attorney. And I see my time is up here.
Nice. One quick question, Judge Slater, if I can follow up.
Yes, you may.
You keep referring to the attorney's conduct is shocking the conscience. Do we have to reach that level of concern in order to believe an evidentiary hearing is necessary to ferret out whether the conduct met with the Strickland standard? You're muted, by the way.
Sorry, Your Honor. No, that is not the legal standard when I say shocking the conscience. That's just a reference that an attorney, to me, it would shock the conscience that an attorney wouldn't do that. What the court has to follow is the Strickland test that a normal, competent lawyer, given the circumstances, would have found it reasonable representation to allow a cognitive 14-year-old to go through a plea petition with their future on the line by themselves. Thank you.
Very well. You'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal, and so counsel for respondent, if you would please identify yourself, and then you may begin.
Thank you very much, Your Honors. Anthony Mark Rubin, attorney for the respondent. Defendant Matthias, appellant Matthias Gould, has not pointed to anything that happened at the plea hearing that would give anybody any indication that he didn't understand what was happening. He was an adult pleading guilty to adult crimes. The plea record from March 20th, 2020 exists, and it gives you everything that you need to make this decision.
That's the concern I've got, and I'll let you address it, because the district court seemed to take that same view.
Yeah.
Everything you need is in the plea colloquy, when the standard of whether you get an evidentiary hearing, I think, isn't you look at all the evidence in the plea colloquy, you look at the evidence asserted in the petition and the affidavits in support. I take it you defend the district court's analysis in this case.
Indeed, Your Honor, and I appreciate that positioning of that question. The statements made in this direct attack on the statements made at the time of the plea hearing, those statements do not require a credibility finding.
No. If a client says in a plea colloquy, I understand, and you find out later that I'm not saying that's the appellant in this case. I'm just giving you a hypothetical. You find out later that the appellant has the IQ of a kumquat based upon evidence that wasn't discussed at the plea colloquy. Doesn't that raise a factual question as to whether the statement, I understand, is sufficient to meet the constitutional knowing and intelligent guilty plea?
You know, it's the question that poses is, does that put us in a spot where we're going to unduly burden post-conviction courts?
Wait a minute. When you say unduly burden post-conviction courts, the statute has a presumption that post-conviction courts are burdened. Well, let me just take you a different way. I have three concerns. I want to see if you share them with the district court's analysis. So if you have the district court's order handy, I'm gonna quote from it here.
Thank you.
On page 4 of the district court's analysis, there's I'll just preface that I have some concern about the law and some concern about the logic of the district court and then the process the district court employed. So the first goes to the law. On page 4, the district court says, citing Ecker as the source, and I'm going to quote here from the district court, it is the petitioner's burden to set forth facts in the petition by a fair preponderance of the evidence. Is that an accurate statement of the law?
The petition by a fair preponderance of the evidence? Yes, that's, I believe that's Williams, I believe that's Payne, I believe those are all the cases that are on
point. Well, the court cited Ecker here, so let's go to Ecker and see if the court accurately stated the proposition. Here's what Ecker says, that the petitioner has, and I'm going to quote here, the burden of establishing the facts set forth in the petition by a preponderance of the evidence. See the difference? Okay. The district court in this case says the burden is on the petitioner to set forth facts in the petition by a preponderance of the evidence, citing Ecker. And what Ecker actually says is the burden is on the petitioner to establish or prove the facts in the petition by a preponderance of the evidence. So my question for you is, assuming that Ecker accurately states the law and the district court did not, what is the procedural mechanism by which a petitioner can, quote, establish the facts set forth in the petition by a preponderance of the evidence?
It's my understanding of my position that the operative focus is what's available at the time of the plea hearing.
No, my question is, when the district courts, when Ecker says the petitioner at the post-conviction has the burden of establishing the facts set forth in the petition by a preponderance of the evidence, isn't the mechanism by which a petitioner can establish those facts by a preponderance the evidentiary hearing?
If there was a need for extrinsic evidence to come into play, but I don't think that's what the law actually supports.
Well, the law says, unless it conclusively, unless you look at the affidavits and the petition, and there's conclusive, it's certain that you don't get, there's no way you can win, even if these things are true. That's when you don't get a hearing. We're only talking about a hearing now. My problem is the district court analyzed this as if there would be no, as if the district court was weighing facts based upon what's in the petition, not looking at the petition to see whether there should be a hearing. Well, let me take you to another concern I have in the district court's analysis, and this is on page 6.
Okay.
The district court says, petitioner knew the goal was to complete treatment in the NERCC, and if he was successful, he could avoid prison. And here's what the district court says. Even a 14-year-old or someone with the cognitive ability of a 14-year-old understands that if told, if you do X, then Y. And the court goes on, this, of course, logically means that if you do not do X, then Y will not happen. Do you agree with the proposition of the district court here?
That a person in that position being told that if they do...
No, that, I'm just talking about the logical equation the district court presented. If X, then Y.
I do.
And therefore, if not X, then not Y. Do you see any problem with that?
In the statements as they relate to this case, I think that's what we would refer to as the deal.
I'm going to suggest to you, as it relates to this case, what the court said was, of course, as the court said, of course, it logically means such and such, that if X doesn't happen, then Y will not happen. What's curious to me is I thought, this reminds me of something. What does it remind me of? And I thought, I know what it reminds me of. Philosophy class in college, first year. It's actually what's called a propositional fallacy. If X, then Y. Not X, therefore not Y. That's what the district court said is a certain truth. And in fact, what philosophers say is that's actually a logical fallacy. It's not a truth at all. It's not absolutely logical, as the district court suggests. The opposite is true. If I say to you, if you eat 100 donuts a week, you'll become overweight. And then you say, okay, well, I won't eat 100 donuts a week. That doesn't mean you're not going to become overweight if you decide to eat 50 pies instead. The district court offered a logical propositional fallacy and then base the reasoning on it. You don't have any problem with that.
Well, I think that the operative focus again, and that's the way that the logic is put forth. It's been, if I'm out of my form of the tautology versus the, then I accept that. But I do believe that what's being put forth is the suggestion that Appellant Gould was told that is the deal, the opportunity to go to NERC, start sexual offender predator treatment, and then come back at sentencing and argue dispositional departure.
Okay, hold on. Let me pause you there because I don't want to miss out on my opportunity to vent about another concern in the district court's analysis. So the district court, based upon what seems to be a misunderstanding of the standard of law by misstating the standard of Ecker, goes into its own fact-finding inquiry and then makes a determination that, well, the preponderance of evidence doesn't support the petitioner's claim. Here's my concern. Wouldn't you agree with me that at least in all the cases I found, when our court has said that's fine, or the Supreme Court has said that's fine, either the district court or this court actually undertakes a comparison between what's in the petition and the affidavits and what happened at the plea colloquy. Are you concerned at all in this case when the district court does its fact finding and then states a proposition of what is a preponderance of the evidence, that the district court doesn't mention the any of the statements in the affidavits, doesn't mention the names of the affiant, doesn't even mention that affidavits exist? Should that not be a concern?
To be honest, it's something that's discretion. It doesn't matter when we look at the cases that this court and the Supreme Court have put forth. The inquiry is simply, what did the judge know at the time of the plea hearing? And so if these were put before this judge, if he considered them, if he didn't, that's not for me to say. The operative focus really makes it look to what happened in that plea hearing on March 20th.
I thought the statute says, I mean, your argument is a solid one. If your argument is that the petitioner really understood what was happening. The problem is there's a threshold question here, which is the petitioner entitled to an evidentiary hearing before getting to that question? And that's what it seems to me, you at least have to point to stuff in the affidavit and say, here's why it's not contradictory to what happened at the plea. It seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong.
No, I understand. And I think that's what in our briefing, that was what we called out as footnote one. The concern, obviously, that cynicism of thinking, well, somebody who took their chance, put in a plea, and then let's say that they actually don't have the IQ of a kumquat, but they're actually brilliant. And they take this opportunity, and it's the am I lying now or was I lying then analysis. And so we have to have a basis for what we're going to look at. And so that's why you've heard me say focus, when we have to focus on what is within the plea petition.
Okay, so am I lying now or am I lying then? You've got here a petitioner saying, I was never told about the consequence of prison. I didn't know what the term was going to be. And my lawyer never explained that to me.
And that's inconsistent with what we have from the plea petition. We have Mr. Downs asking, Mr. Gould, you understand what you've been charged with, correct? You've given up your right to a jury trial. Yes.
Okay, where in the colloquy does it suggest that the defendant was told, you understand the prison term that you face?
You understand that you and I, page 9, you and I are going to argue for a departure at sentencing. And part of that plea agreement, but a part of the plan, we're going to attempt to get you to treatment through Mr. Pogacnik in probation up at NERC. Our hope is that you can avoid potential prison time by doing well in treatment on a pretrial status. Correct. Defendant, yes.
Right. We hope that you might avoid the potential for prison. Where is there a clear and conclusive statement that the defendant understood the consequence of prison? I mean, that statement is at least vague. I think you would acknowledge it could be. I'm sure if it was you, you'd have been more precise in the colloquy. But that we're not stuck with it. We're stuck with the facts.
We can all agree. as all of us attorneys, officers of the court, we can all agree that we would have liked to have seen a more complete, more thorough, more frequent contact, you know, all of these things. We would have liked to have seen that, but that's not the focus. And while we're on the quick discussion with 2 minutes of the question on ineffective counsel, I would point out to remind, we heard a recitation of the first prong of Strickland. Do not forget, the issue is the second prong of Strickland. Did the lack of communication prejudice Mr. Gould in any way? I mean, it's not unreasonable to think that a defendant's actions or lack of action in between the time that he enters a guilty plea and sentencing would not have a bearing at the sentencing. That's unreasonable to think it. And so the judge noted Gould got the best deal he was ever going to get, and he was going to give him probation if Gould would have done his part, but he didn't. And that's what the focus is. The inquiry, again, is what the judge knew at the time of the plea hearing.
Well, that's the best deal he was going to get, but after he pleaded guilty. But I think isn't the question whether he would have pleaded guilty at all? Isn't that the inquiry of prejudice when it comes to a guilty plea?
With no prejudice, he doesn't get a new trial or the opportunity to withdraw the plea. So we can question the quality of the work that was done. But if the opportunity was going to be to plead and then have a chance to go interim to NERC to start his sexual programming, if that wasn't part of the offer, if that wasn't part of the understanding, if that wasn't part of the deal, then he wouldn't have had that opportunity. He was given this opportunity.
I thought the argument, maybe I'm misunderstanding the argument and Mr. Rahm can clarify, but that if he had been properly, on the ineffective assistance of counsel, had I been properly advised by my counsel meeting the Strickland standard, I would have not pleaded guilty. I would have gone to trial, or I would have waited for or negotiated a better plea deal or something. I thought that was the prejudice that was being asserted, but counsel are both here. You can correct my understanding.
I appreciate that question. If there wasn't if there was a trial, there wouldn't have been this opportunity to go to NERC. It would have been appealing to the Commissioner of Corrections for an interim commit. There wouldn't have been this chance, this window, this start, this prove, this show your work so that we can come back at sentencing and give you this chance that, looking at the circumstances.
No, I'm not. I'm saying not if there was a trial. I'm saying if he chose to withdraw his guilty plea. I mean, isn't that the question of prejudice? We don't go to whether you got a better deal if you end up going to trial and then losing. We don't go that far down the line. Isn't our only question when it comes to prejudice for a guilty plea withdrawal or effective assistance of counsel at the time of a guilty plea, whether or not a different decision would have been made with regard to accepting the plea? I thought that was the only harm that would have to, or the prejudice that would have to be shown. Maybe I'm misunderstanding the law. That's always been my understanding.
If the second prong is that a reasonable probability but for unprofessional errors and the result or the outcome would have been different.
Right, no, I understand that. My understanding when it comes to a plea agreement and allegations of ineffective assistance of counsel, the outcome isn't the ultimate outcome of the trial or the sentence. The outcome is, would a defendant have made a different decision with regard to accepting the plea? I thought that's all the further you go. Correct me if I'm wrong about the law.
It's certainly my understanding that the result or outcome is the focus of the inquiry when it comes to prejudice. Not simply if he would have changed his mind, but if he would have changed his mind if he knew that the result or outcome was going to be significantly different. Oh, if he could have created a better outcome, and then he might have tried. But if the outcome is what the outcome is, and it was, in fact, this was the best deal that he was going to get, this is the opportunity to have probation, that is what the outcome would have actually gotten better had he done what he said that he wanted to do.
Very well. I see no other questions, and your time has expired. Thank you, Mr. Rubin. And Mr. Rahm, you may now proceed with 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you. I would just like to start where opposing counsel kind of left off in regards to he wouldn't have had this opportunity part of this deal. Again, it's shifting back to that it's treated as this was a deal. It was not a deal. It was a straight plea that my client, it doesn't matter if you plead guilty to everything, you absolutely have the right to try to get yourself in treatment. You absolutely have the right to argue for a departure, whether the state likes it or not. That's not an agreement. That's a straight plea, and it keeps being the attitude of the both the brief and the argument and the district court is that there was somehow an agreement here that, and there wasn't. My client was entitled to enter a straight plea and argue for what he wanted to. He didn't need the permission of the prosecutor to agree to that. And I
would counsel, if that had been the case, sentencing would have been in 35 days, and your client would not have had an opportunity to participate in treatment and show to the court that he could do that. I can tell you, as a trial court judge that handled literally hundreds of sex crimes, just having the evaluation isn't very persuasive to a judge. Getting into treatment and proving you can do it can be persuasive. So whether this was stated as an agreement, this was a nice deal that the county offered him and gave him here.
Your Honor, I guess I would respectfully disagree. I don't think there was, you know, any deal outside of the sure sentencing was pushed off. I agree with that. It could have happened sooner, but there was no promise or agreement that said, hey, you're going to get some benefit. Again, even if the recommendations would have came back by probation recommending a departure, this was still a presumptive 144-month prison commit, which means the judge could have still sentenced him to prison. I understand the language of the district court that it was very likely that it would have granted a departure, but that wasn't known to my client. And I think to jump back to the petition and the affidavits that were submitted, has been pointed out by this court, it's to, and by myself, that the petition and affidavits and all the evidence is supposed to be construed in the light most favorable to the petitioner. When you look at the affidavit of petitioner, when you look at affidavit of grandfather Dennis Gold, when you look at the affidavit of biological father and aunt, it's clear that in order for this court to believe that there wasn't some sort of confusion, the belief would have to be that all these individuals aren't telling the truth, that in fact, it was clear to them exactly what was going to happen. And that's completely contradictory to the affidavits that were submitted. And again, the court's supposed to construe those in favor to the petitioner. And there are evidence included in the plea petition and the sentencing transcript that clearly make that there was some confusion. Opposing counsel even admitted that some of this was vague. Well, when you're dealing with acknowledging that this was vague and could have been more complete, and you have affidavits under oath stating it was very confusing, we didn't know what's going on, certainly petitioner should be entitled to an evidentiary hearing to have credibility. The state hasn't submitted any affidavits by Mr. Downs saying, hey, look, what's submitted in these affidavits is inaccurate. Here's what really happened. And I was crystal clear with the client what was going to happen. There's been nothing to rebut what has been submitted, which is the point of an evidentiary hearing.
Would you agree that I'm trying to distinguish the ineffective assistance petition, part of the petition, from the lack of intelligent entry of a plea? Would you agree that it's that a judge could find after an evidentiary hearing that there was a lack of intelligent guilty plea without finding ineffective assistance of counsel?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe a district court could find that someone did not enter an intelligent plea, but also received effective assistance of counsel. I'm sure a district court could do that. And
do you think that same distinction is part of our appellate review of the two separate claims for ineffective assistance of counsel and whether the court erred in failing to hold an evidentiary hearing on each?
Yeah, I think the Court of Appeals for that position is supposed to look at both claims individually, but I do agree there's some overlap between the two because ineffective assistance of counsel can lead to an unintelligent plea, but both can be separate as well.
And can you answer Judge Ross's question? Because that's a good question about the what the better result, how the result would have been different. What is your understanding of how we look at that?
Your Honor, my understanding is you look at the ultimate what could have gone differently had petitioner understood that it was a presumption of 144 months and that it was his burden to prove to the court to grant a departure, that his result, his understanding of that would have changed the circumstances, and that he either would have gone to trial, knowing that it's presumed he's going to prison for 144 months, or at a minimum, he would have rejected that plea agreement and tried to negotiate something else. But I think the court is to look at, in regards to Strickland, could the result have been different? And certainly in the affidavit of petitioner, it states that had he known this, he would have gone to trial. I see I'm out of time.
Any other questions?
Counsel, one quick question. If you succeeded and he was now allowed to go to trial, is there anything stopping the district court from sentencing at the top of the range following trial?
There would be nothing if client was found guilty, I assume, is what your honor's asking. Then no, there would be nothing to stop the court. Obviously, there would be arguments made. But there would be nothing. The court, it's within their discretion to sentence within the box, if you
will. And the court could not make the 90 days concurrent and make that consecutive as well, so that he could end up in prison for a lot longer than he's looking at now if you succeed. Would you agree?
I would disagree, a lot longer given good time and what the top of the box is. But again, that's something that should be up to my client to make that determination, if that risk is worth it. And according to the affidavit he submitted, that's the route he would have gone.
Okay, but you would agree that the evidence against him is pretty strong?
I would not agree with that, Your Honor, respectfully.
You read the reports and you don't agree with that?
I do not, Your Honor. My client has a presumption of innocence, and that's what I believe he has in this case.
Yeah, but the child's mother caught him in the act virtually. And he admitted to the police that he'd committed criminal sexual conduct in the first degree.
Well, certainly that my client would have the right to confront mom in this case and cross-examine her. And my client would have the opportunity to testify, to state any pressure or any undue influence he felt by answering the police officer's questions in this case.
But he waived his omnibus hearing, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Jerome, this is just anecdotal. I remember shortly after I started on the court, there was a case similar to this where the grandmother of was the one who reported the defendant to police because she caught the defendant in the act of obvious sexual misconduct with the child. And it was a similar case as this where a lawyer came up on appeal and pointed out some errors in the, or at least alleged errors in the plea negotiations. And it turns out that the sentence that the defendant had received was an extraordinary one that probably was unlawfully low, quite low, but no one had objected to it. And I remember asking the lawyer, similar to what Judge Kirk is asking you, like, listening between the lines, are you sure you want the victory? because you're going to get the prize at the end. And I won't say anything further about what happened in that case after the oral argument and after our decision, but certainly something that I'm sure you've discussed with your client, but I have the same concerns that Judge Kirk is implying. And I'll just leave it at that. It's not a direct question. You don't have to answer, but just put it out there.
Well, and I'll just follow up that we take 90 days typically, and it's usually in the second, the third month of that where you'll see an order towards the end. And we often will tell parties that, including following oral argument discussion, because that does add a little bit of more information perhaps for everyone. So certainly let us know before that point if there is a change of heart. But we thank both counsel for your answers to our questions today and your briefing. We will take the matter under advisement, issue an order within 90 days. We will be turning down to case number 3 for our oral argument calendar. So you each have a good day. Thank you.
Thank you. You as well.